Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, as Pope Francis announces a May pilgrimage to the Holy Land to mark 50 years since the historic visit of Pope Paul VI, we step back in time to bring you echoes of that journey. We bring you a musical meditation focusing on the baptism of the Lord, and take you on a tour of a place here in Rome where St. Francis once stayed. But first of all, as almost always at this time of week, the Pope and the people. For this, we join Linda Bordoni as she reports on the weekly general audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world.
Pope Francis on Wednesday reflected on the great gift we received when we were baptized. Addressing the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square for the weekly general audience, the Pope began a series of catechesis on the sacraments, starting with baptism.
Oggi iniziamo una serie di catechesi sui sacramenti, e la prima riguarda il battesimo.
For the first catechesis of the year, Pope Francis highlighted the first of the Church's seven sacraments, baptism. And as he had already done in the past, he invited those present to find out the date on which they were baptized.
Domandate la data del battesimo.
A happy date, he said, which marks the day in which we received a great gift. And Pope Francis urged the over 10,000 people gathered in the square not to forget that gift, which gives us new birth in Christ, makes us sharers in the mystery of his death and resurrection, grants the forgiveness of sin, and brings us new freedom as God's children and members of his Church.
Siamo diventati nuove creature e siamo stati rivestiti di Cristo.
Our baptism has changed us, Francis said. It has given us a new and glorious hope and empowered us to bring God's redeeming love to all, particularly the poor, in which we see the face of Christ. Our baptism, he continued, has also given us a share in the Church's mission of evangelization. And as is common practice during the Wednesday General Audience, the Pope had words in different languages for visitors from across the globe. To those from the Middle East, and in particular from Syria, he said, "Remember the day of your baptism and celebrate it, because thanks to this sacrament we have all become new creatures in Christ, members of the Church, capable of forgiving and loving all, even our enemies." I'm Linda Bordoni.
Many thanks there to Linda Bordoni for bringing us this report. Moving on in the broadcast. On Sunday, 5th of January, Pope Francis made a much-expected announcement, that of his forthcoming pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Speaking to the pilgrims gathered around him in St. Peter's Square, he told them how, God willing, this coming spring, precisely from the 24th to the 26th of May, he'll travel to Amman, Bethlehem and Jerusalem.
Desidero annunciare che dal 24 al 26 maggio prossimo, a Dio piacendo, compirò un pellegrinaggio in Terra Santa.
The main purpose of this journey, he specified, is to commemorate the historic meeting between Pope Paul VI and the ecumenical patriarch Athenagoras I of Constantinople.
Scopo principale è commemorare lo storico incontro tra il Papa Paolo VI e il Patriarca Athenagora.
Pope Francis then added how on his visit there would also be an ecumenical meeting held at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre with the representatives of the Christian churches of Jerusalem, together with Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople, Pope Francis ended his announcement by asking for prayers for the success of this pilgrimage. Now, as we know, Paul VI was the first Roman pontiff to be referred to as Pilgrim Pope. It was he who decided the time had come to bring the papacy to the people. Convinced that all roads no longer led to Rome, he became the first pope ever to board an aeroplane. And so it was that less than a year into his pontificate, he became the first pope to return to the Holy Land after St. Peter himself. Among the journalists to witness this event was American Bob Miller, who reported on this historic pilgrimage. He recalled the emotion of seeing Paul VI on the banks of the River Jordan.
The closest I got to him was at the River Jordan, when he walked down the stone steps that they had arranged there at the spot where tradition says John the Baptist baptized Jesus. I first snapped a picture of the Pope, and I'm kind of at the side there. So I was able to watch him. He didn't speak. He merely gazed at the waters and then very slowly turned and walked up the steps and continued the journey.
Our visit is a spiritual one, a humble pilgrimage to the sacred places made holy by the birth, the life, passion, and death of Jesus Christ, and by his glorious resurrection and ascension.
Another person to have personal memories of this pilgrimage is American Cardinal Justin Regali. He highlights how at the heart of this landmark journey was the historic meeting in the Garden of Olives with the head of the Orthodox Church of the time, Patriarch Athanagoras I of Constantinople, after 9 centuries of disunion. But let's listen to Cardinal Regali.
Meeting came in the context of the Second Vatican Council. It came in the context of the tremendous sensitivity that Pope Paul VI had for Christian unity. And it turned out to be an extremely important milestone in the history of relations between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. Certainly, from the point of view of Pope Paul VI, I know it meant so much to him. It took place in the context of his visit to the Holy Land, that marvelous day when he embraced Patriarch Athanagoras, his smiling face. We remember the tremendous embrace.
Roma et Constantinopoli pie peregrinantibus, invicem obvia mire et commune supplicationes consociare.
But above all, it was a moment in the relationship between the churches, and that is something extremely important. It was what Vatican II would eventually codify Unitatis Redentae Gratio, the value of spiritual ecumenism also, because the Pope went to Jerusalem to pray, and he prayed with Athanagoras, and later on Vatican II would speak to us about the very core of ecumenism, prayer and conversion of heart. I also know for a fact that the Pope had an immense personal esteem for Athanagoras. The last 8.5 years of his life, I was with him on many, many occasions because I was his English language translator. Private audiences with people who were English speaking and speaking about Patriarch Athanagoras. I remember how his face lighted up and Athanagoras was mentioned. So it was an extraordinary event in the life of Pope Paul VI. It was an extraordinary event in the history of the Church.
And now we've listened to Cardinal Justin Regali. Let's recall how this visit of Pope Francis to the Holy Land in the footsteps of his predecessors to the See of Peter from Paul VI, then to Blessed John Paul II in the year 2000 and to Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus in 2009, is not his first to this part of the world. Although the last time he was here goes back 40 years to October 1973, when he was Jesuit Provincial Superior in Argentina. But why don't I end by letting you listen to the words of Pope Francis in Italian as he asks for prayers for this forthcoming pilgrimage to the Holy Land.
Fin da ora vi domando di pregare per questo pellegrinaggio che sarà un pellegrinaggio di preghiera.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed stepping back in time with me there as we look forward to the pilgrimage of prayer of Pope Francis to the Holy Land. Meanwhile, why not listen to an enlightening musical meditation with Monsignor Philip Whitmore?
I did not know before that nature could be so beautiful. It was like the Garden of Eden. That was how John Henry Newman described his visit to Sicily in 1833, 12 years before he became a Catholic. This visit was in many ways a turning point in his life. While he was there, he took ill with a fever and came close to death. It was after his recovery, on the boat returning from Sicily to Marseille, that he wrote The Pillar of the Cloud, better known by its opening words, "Lead, kindly light." This lovely poem is a great comfort to anyone who's been through a period of darkness, as Newman had during his illness. It speaks of faith that the light of Christ will always point the way forward, even though the night is dark and I am far from home. At the end of verse 1, Newman speaks from the heart, reminding us of his great struggle to recognize the path along which God was leading him. I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough. Lead, Kindly Light can be sung to several different tunes. My favourite is the one we've been listening to. It's called Lux Benigna, meaning kindly light. Newman himself was very fond of this tune, and it was written by one of the most prolific hymn composers of all time, J.B. Dykes. During the 1850s, Dykes was a minor canon at Durham Cathedral. When he heard of the plan to publish Hymns Ancient and Modern, the first large-scale collection of hymns in the English language, he rather timidly sent a few of his own compositions to the editor. They were well received, and he was asked for more. In the end, 60 of his tunes were included. Here's one that's still popular today. Those in peril on the sea. And here's another. In honour of the Blessed Trinity. A more recent setting of Lead Kindly Light is to a tune called Alberta by Sir William Harris, one of the leading figures in Anglican church music in the first half of the 20th century. I don't suppose too many of you will have heard it. Better remembered for his choral music, and his greatest work is the glorious Fair is the Heaven, to a poem by Edmund Spenser. To give you an idea of his style, I'd like to play you a passage where the music tells of angels and archangels attending on God's own person without rest or end. Angels waiting on us in Newman's poem as well. In the closing lines, the kindly light which has led us on all through the night brings us safely into their presence. And with the dawn those angel faces smile, which I have loved long since and lost a while.
Monsignor Philip Whitmore is a music historian who's currently rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome. So now we've gone musical, why not be a little enterprising and go down Curiosity Lane by means of a virtual tour of a place here in Rome linked in a special way to the Pope's namesake, Francis, a one-time cell of his hidden away above a church by the name of Francis on the same side of the River Tiber as St. Peter's. Join me in San Francesco a Ripa, then, with Professor Breda Ennis. We're in a chapel above the main church of San Francesco a Ripa, Breda. We're sitting on chairs in a room where St. Francis once lived, no?
He's believed to have stayed here when he came to Rome with also another member of his order, Brother Leo. And actually what we see here, this small room, this rectangular room, in effect was actually originally two cells. And afterwards they were put together and the little chapel was made of the entire space. So here you can see these nude walls that go back, we're talking here now to the 13th century.
And slightly charred, no?
Yes, in fact, it's sort of weather-worn, but in a nice sense. And inside a little grating on the right-hand side of the altar, there is a stone which apparently St. Francis used as a cushion when he stayed here. So the whole place is permeated with the feeling of St. Francis, because people generally go to places like Gubbio and Assisi, etc. But here in Rome is this hidden little place of St. Francis of Assisi where I think a real tranquility, a real peace has remained, regardless of a busy, bustling city outside. So here you have this little treasure area. The actual chapel itself, in my feeling, is a reliquary in itself, more than being just a sanctuary or a chapel. It's actually, we're inside a relic, in a way. But additions which were made to this little space, this nude space, at a later stage in the Baroque period, they built a type of, let's say, a reasonably simple altar made of wood, mahogany. And you can see a big panel area behind. In the middle, you can see a painting of St. Francis of Assisi. It's a copy of what was supposed to have been an original painting of what St. Francis of Assisi actually looked like. So this was done in the 13th or 14th century. They don't have an exact date for it. And it was done by Mangiaritone of Arezzo. We have this slim figure in the middle with this beautiful cross in his hand, the red one, and wearing his Franciscan robes. And again, the hands are very simple. You feel like you're on the threshold between sort of late medieval painting and you're moving into the area where you're going towards Giotto and where you're going into the Renaissance eventually, and where you get movement into the figures, because there's a certain pathos and simplicity and beauty in this painting. Not too many things are added to it. It's just very simply St. Francis holding the list of the order, of the regulations of his order in his hand, the cross in the other. You see behind it is a gold background again, which is like the Byzantine background, which represents eternity and represents the celestial sphere, where we now use blue a lot for that. They used gold to pull you into something that was beyond your life. And the magic trick and the most amazing part of this little chapel is that when they move a piece of equipment behind the altar inside a tiny little cupboard, the whole place behind the altar opens up into various little sections where an outpop about 1,000, apparently there are about 1,000 relics.
This is one of Rome's best kept secrets, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So it's like a massive, gigantic reliquary with all kinds of saints' relics, and a lot of them relating to the various saints as well in the Franciscan order. And again, you see above the wood, it's all done in wood, and you have wooden curtains, let's say, with sort of golden pieces, trestles. You have angels holding up the curtains as if they're trying to reveal the treasures that are behind inside the cupboard. It's extraordinary. And also the wood is very rich mahogany and gold. And again, as you come back from the altar, you can see the candles, the candelabra, which is a long, slim candelabra, over the altar, at least, let's say, reasonably near the altar, but to be exact. Again, in this wonderful gold, you get the feeling that something of the gold quality of the spirit of St. Francis is permeating the entire room, helping you to relate to these relics, but more important, in my opinion, is to bring yourself into contact with that special piece that is absolutely distinctive for St. Francis of Assisi. It's a kind of peace you feel in every place where he's been, and you can really feel it here. That's the greatest treasure that he has left behind, the spiritual peace that you can actually feel.
And a big thank you there to Professor Breda Ennis, who teaches fine arts at the American University of Rome. And now we've been down Curiosity Lane, time to join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese, who presents a programme by the title of God's Friends, in which he brings us some very Christian thoughts.
If you have ever walked around Rome or any capital city, you will have been approached by people asking you for money. Some are polite, some rude, and some really aggressive or even frightening. If you're dressed as a priest, they are drawn to you like bees to a honeypot. A friend was complaining recently that people were greeting me just because I was dressed as a priest. But that was an easy day. Most days it is a question of being approached several times by people begging. But how do you decide to whom you should give money? Many priests and professional carers tell me I should never give anyone money. But it isn't always practical to take people to a shop and buy what they claim they want the money for, or to take them to a bar and buy them something to eat and drink. And many seem just to want the money. In Rome, there are people who are delivered to the city centre, especially to the places where tourists and pilgrims gather in nice cars. They arrive dressed quite normally and vanish for a few moments. When they reappear, they look like wizened old hags and have developed an apparently uncontrollable tremor in their arms or heads. When it rains, they run off to find shelter. And at the end of a day's work, they are picked up again and taken home looking normal again. It must be lucrative, because some of those faces have been in the same places for years. Besides, they cannot possibly have their little territory by accident. That seems to be carefully controlled as well. At the opposite extreme, there are people whose clothes and bodies stink of unmentionable substances, who cannot possibly be there just to make money. They really need help. But is it a good idea to give them money? People who spin fascinating and plausible stories extract various amounts of money from me, and the next time I see them, they're drunk or high on drugs. That is when I really think, why bother? I know we're supposed to give generously from what has been given to us, but is it wise to feed people's weaknesses? But I have to be careful. It is tempting to feel sore that we've been fooled or tricked. If I refuse to give because I'm afraid of looking silly, what kind of reason is that? If I really do worry about how people may spend the money, that may be a good reason not to give them any. But I usually have no idea. Is it worth taking the risk? One person suggested that I should give something to the first person who asked each day. But that excludes needy cases coming along later. On the other hand, I cannot solve everyone's problems, so perhaps I should feel no guilt about that. My instinct is to give people the benefit of the doubt. After all, we could be entertaining angels without knowing it, like Abraham in the book of Genesis. And people who live by the gospel know that they will be judged by God according to how they have treated the weakest and the most needy. Chapter 25 of Matthew's gospel makes it clear that we should see Jesus Christ in the face of the people we see around us who are in need. My problem is, I don't see Jesus very often. He may be there, but I don't see him. My eyes see professional beggars, or desperate drug or alcohol addicts, or nuisances, and occasionally, just occasionally, people who are obviously desperately in need. I have to learn that it is worth bothering for one very simple reason. They may be people I find it hard to bear, but they could be God's friends. Sometimes, a British gentleman of the streets who has been here in Rome since the 1975 Holy Year tells me very wise things and reveals what a deep spiritual life he has. True enough, at other times he yells and doesn't even know who I am, but he is clearly one of God's friends. Perhaps he's been able to teach me that because we're from the same culture, and I think I understand even the words he doesn't say. If I make a high-minded excuse for not giving money, it may salve my conscience and justify my not giving, but it will help nobody. If I try to see things differently and presume the best, I may be wasting some money, but I won't be refusing one of God's friends.
Many, many thanks there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese for sharing with us this reflection. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to find out more about our programming, the address is www.rv.va and then click on the English World icon. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.